Do we really have free will? And if so, what are its limits?
Most people, I'm speaking obviously about a rather privileged group, but they do grow up thinking they will have choices and they will be able to make certain decisions. And I think it's a rather uneasy discovery when we find out that many of the biggest things that happen in our lives happen almost randomly. Often who we end up with as a partner, quite often job choices are rather random. Our choice of friends or occupations or where we end up living. All these things happen in much more haphazard ways than I think we're comfortable acknowledging.
That's Margot Livesay. Her new novel, The Boy in the Field, explores the limits of free will and how we respond to what happens to us. Then an emergency room doctor evaluates the lessons of 25 years in emergency medicine and their relevance to life and writing.
The questions that arise from these interactions and the questions that come up from practicing in a hospital for many years are really the questions I think that are universal, that apply to us all. And so one of the messages I hope, or the intentions of this book, was not simply to write about medicine, but to use medicine as a vehicle to explore some other larger questions that a novelist might be interested in, for example, or another genre of writing.
That's Frank Hyler. We talk with him about his memoir, White Hot Light, 25 Years in Emergency Medicine. We also ask him what it's like to be an ER doc in the midst of COVID. Finally, we talk with writer and English professor K.L. Cook about opening up the campus to in-person learning in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rianna. One September afternoon in 1999, teenagers Matthew, Zoe, and Duncan Lang are walking home from school when they discover a boy lying in a field, bloody and unconscious. Thanks to their intervention, the boy's life is saved. But in the aftermath, all three siblings are irrevocably changed. That's the premise of Margot Livesay's terrific new novel, The Boy in the Field. Livesay's one of my favorite fiction writers. We've had her on the show twice before to talk about her novels, The Flight of Gemma Hardy and The House on Fortune Street. They're both wonderful novels, but I think my favorite is her new one, The Boy in the Field. In language that's pared down to the essential, Livesay creates a story that's compelling and deeply satisfying. I fell in love with her characters, including a remarkable dog of great wisdom and compassion. The Boy in the Field is Margot Livesay's ninth novel. Originally from the UK, she lives in the US. Well, Margot Livesay, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much, Francesca. It's wonderful to be back talking to you.
And I am so glad that you are here to have a chance to talk about this wonderful novel, The Boy in the Field. Who is the boy in the field and who found him?
Those are the perfect opening questions. I will begin with the second one. The boy in the field is found by three teenage siblings, Matthew, Zoe, and Duncan Lang, as they are walking home from school one September afternoon in 1999. And all this is taking place in the countryside outside Oxford, England, and in Oxford itself. And the boy that they find in the field is a 19-year-old named Carol. He's a Czech immigrant and who works in a local hospital. And he has been assaulted for reasons we won't know for quite a number of pages.
So these three siblings, the characters are all so appealing. You've told us their names, but just tell us a very little bit about each one.
Matthew, the oldest, who's 17, about to go to university, is an ardent fencer. He has a girlfriend whom he likes. And after finding the boy in the field, he begins to, he becomes a kind of detective. He tries to follow in the footsteps of people he's seen on in films and read about in books. Zoe, who's nearly 16, is a would-be poet, a budding poet, if you will. And she becomes very anxious to become someone who isn't a daughter and isn't a sister. She wants someone who sees her as Zoe, as herself. And she goes looking, one might say, for romance. And Duncan, the youngest, at 13, is adopted. His birth mother is Turkish, and he's an artist. And after finding the boy in the field, he decides that he really needs to find his birth mother, whom he has previously given very little thought to.
And this is a momentous event, finding this boy in the field for these three siblings. What does it set off in them? How does it change them?
Well, each of them, I mean, it's not like they are naive. Zoe, for instance, once sees a flasher, a man who exposes himself to her in the churchyard. Matthew has seen various things. So they're not naive, but it's their first, I think, really visceral experience of both the existence of evil in the world and the randomness of evil, and how, you know, this idea we have of making decisions, of making choices, you know, we speak about it as if we were, I don't know, building a fence, how actually it's not quite as simple as that. We don't have as much free will as we would like.
Could you say more about that? We don't have as much free will. What constrains us?
Well, I think we grow up, most people, I'm speaking obviously about a rather privileged group, but they do grow up thinking they will have choices and they will be able to make certain decisions. And I think it's a rather uneasy discovery when we find out that many of the biggest things that happen in our lives happen almost randomly. Often who we end up with as a partner, quite often job choices are rather random. Our choice of friends or occupations or where we end up living. All these things happen in much more haphazard ways than I think we're comfortable acknowledging.
And yet your characters do confront having to make decisions. I mean, for example, you mentioned Duncan looking for his mother, something he hadn't intended to do beforehand. He has a kind of vision, a shadowy figure in a field that he just feels is telling him. I mean, he knows there isn't an actual physical being there, but it's telling him to go look for his mother, and he's confronted with a decision. And also, he brings that decision to his parents and his siblings. Say a little bit more about that process. It was absolutely captivating.
Yes, and I think that Duncan's decision to look for his birth mother is the one that maybe reverberates most throughout the family, that everybody is alarmed about this, and everybody feels that they must help him as best they can, that it would be cruel not to help him. I think of Duncan as being very happy in his family, and yet once the idea has entered his head about his birth mother, he can't let go of the fact that he would really like to find this person and to find out where he comes from. Why is his skin the color that it is? Why are his hands the shape that they are? Does he get his love of color, for instance, from his birth mother?
And also, I mean, he's an artist. I mean, he's so, I want to say, he's an artist. He's so beautifully painted in this book. And he has a very particular, a special way of looking at reality. Describe it a bit more. I think you can already tell he's probably my favorite character, although I love them all.
I loved writing about Duncan, too. I really loved the idea of writing about an artist at a young age. And for several reasons, I didn't want it to be a writer because I think the work of young writers, I'm judging perhaps only by myself, is for the most part not very interesting. It's a bit like a dog standing on its hind legs or something. But I think there's a way in which someone can start to see the world as an artist at a very young age, way before they can actually capture what they're seeing on paper or on canvas. And Duncan is such a person. He's very aware of colors, of details, of how things look. And he's an unusually empathetic person. His looking closely at people does lead him into true empathy. And happily, he meets someone in the novel who responds to that in the shape of his new dog.
Yes, that new dog, Lily. And, you know, I even read the acknowledgments in the book, well, which I usually read anyway, but I was charmed to see that Lily is your answer to a reader who asked you why your animals don't talk. I don't think I would ever imagine asking a writer why their animals don't talk. But so tell us about Lily.
And I should say that the person who asked this charming question was a 10-year-old girl at a school I visited in New York City, and all the animals in her stories did talk. I thought this was a wonderful idea, and as a child, I was convinced that our family dog was right on the verge of talking to me. She just wouldn't. So I wanted to introduce a new member into the family who would become a kind of a sort of touchstone almost for at least Duncan and Zoe and to some extent the other members of the family, that Lily would be very aware of their moods and they would be very aware of hers. And she plays a crucial role in the action at certain key moments in preventing people from doing certain things or in urging them to do certain things.
And it's not the only hint of another reality. I mean, I felt like Duncan sees what is underneath the common reality, day-to-day reality, through his artistic vision. Zoe also has experiences of separating from normal daily reality. Talk a little bit about how you bring this in. It's not precisely, you know, I wouldn't call it a cult by any means, but there's another layer that you're referring to of reality.
Yeah, that's very perceptive of you. I think, yes, that's something I very much wanted to suggest throughout the novel, that there's something kind of shimmering below our everyday reality, if you will, that can be experienced in different ways. And I think even Matthew, to some extent, in his efforts to make sense of the world, experiences this other version of reality. In Zoe's case, it takes the form of her just very occasionally sort of stepping out of time, as if she was at a party and, you know, went over to the corner of the room and saw everything that was happening and then came back to the party. And it's something that's been happening to her since she was very small. And like Duncan and his birth mother, she doesn't think about it often until perhaps after finding the boy in the field.
Why does that make her think of that?
I think it makes her think about it because she begins to separate herself from other people and to stop taking things for granted. She starts wondering about truths and lies and, you know, is everybody telling lies? Is anyone telling the truth? And she starts to see herself as an outsider might see her. and, of course, starts looking for the outsider that will see her.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Margot Livesay about her new novel, The Boy in the Field. Yeah, and at one point, she tries an experiment with her siblings. She says, let's not lie at all. Especially she, begins to realize that that's not really possible. Talk about this concept of the law of excluded middle, a truth is somewhere between the binary of true or not true, or that some things are true, other things are not true, but other things are somewhere in the middle.
Yes, and this is an idea I understand probably only about as much as Zoe does. There are many people who understand it much better. But I think one of the things that is interesting about young people and is absolutely wonderful in many cases about young people is their passionate sense of truth and justice. And often that leads, of course, to a reluctance to compromise. And Zoe very much wants to believe there is something called the truth and that we can tell the truth all the time. But when she tries to do that, it leads to all kinds of problems with her friends. And a person she meets introduces her to the idea that the world might not be divided into X and not X. There might be something in between X and not X that somehow combines both or includes both. And she finds that a very fascinating idea.
And as I was thinking about that, it occurred to me that that's something that any novelist, any fiction writer really has to wrestle with in order to develop characters that they can care about.
Yes, I think it's the characters that we cherish in fiction are characters who are genuinely complicated and conflicted. They don't see the world in simple terms, and they don't tend to get their own way all the time.
And so that leads me to the parents, and stop me if I'm saying something I shouldn't, although I saw this in a review, so I figure if it's out in print, I can probably say it. But, you know, Hal, who seems, I mean, the parents, like their children, just seem to be completely decent, really likable people, and people who just soothe the soul. You know, at a time when there's just so much hatred and conflict out in the world, it was really soothing to read a novel like this that was so genuine and real and where the people are so genuinely decent. Yet, Hal is having an affair. You know, is there something of the law of the excluded middle in that one as well?
I hadn't thought of that, but now that you say it, maybe so. Yes, it's true that Hal is having an affair, and it's by no means a simple thing for him. And I think we begin to sense as the novel goes on that his life too jumped the tracks, if you will, when he was a teenager. His father died very suddenly, and he ended up taking over the family business and becoming an artisanal blacksmith rather than going to university as he had hoped and planned. And I think we feel some of the reverberations of that missed opportunity as he finds himself with three busy teenagers and a very busy and successful wife, that he's just sort of looking around a little bit at the roads not taken.
Yeah, and the effect on his children, I mean, they also deal with it, I think, in a very mature way. I mean, I'm really struck by the maturity of all of these children. You talk a little bit about how they take, you know, the impact of they discover that he's having an affair. You know, what the impact is on them.
Yes, for them, it is deeply disturbing, and they feel protective towards their mother. But at the same time, they don't instantly leap to blame or judge their father. I mean, they do blame and judge him, but it's not all they do. They have a deeper understanding than that, I would say. And that deeper understanding, I think, is connected to the ways in which each of them understands that they're part of this family, part of this particular tribe, but also their own person. And they recognize, perhaps without articulating it, that their father is acting as his own person.
Yes, they don't act in a binary way. I mean, they're loyal to him. They want to protect their mother. They don't, you know, they continue to have their own relationship with him instead of, you know, shutting him out of their life.
Yes, and neither of us wants to say what comes of that, but I did want to get in the fact that the novel is set in 1999, and I chose that date very specifically, both because I needed to set my novel in a time before mobile phones were ubiquitous, and also because for two other reasons. I think in 1999, we were all worrying about Y2K and thinking planes would fall from the sky and computers would burst into flames. We were worrying about dangers, but we were worrying perhaps about the wrong dangers. And at the same time, my impression is that both from observation and from research is that at that time, teenagers had more autonomy and were more able to live their own lives without their parents being aware at every moment of what they were doing.
Yes, yes, that's true. I remember those days. And my son was a teenager then, so yes. and then there is the figure of Carol. He's also a very interesting person. Tell us about him. He's the boy in the field. Tell us a little bit about him.
The boy in the field is meant to be, and I think truly is, an enigmatic figure. Each of the three teenagers is very curious about him. I think particularly curious about the idea, did he do something to make this assault happened? Did he do something that provoked someone to attack him or brought this upon him? And they each try to find ways to connect with him. And we do learn a certain amount about him, but we never see him from the inside. We only see him as Matthew, Zoe, and Duncan do. And so he remains this mysterious person. And I tried to signal that very early in the novel by having him, when he's lying in the field, when they first find him, say one word. And it turns out that they each hear that word differently. And I think that's another thing that's at the heart of Zoe's struggles around truth and lies, that question of how we each see the world through our own eyes, through our own perceptions. And yet, is there something called objective reality, or is there something called objective reality, and what does that mean?
So this is your ninth novel. We've had you on the show for two other novels, The House on Fortune Street and The Flight of Gemma Hardy, both wonderful novels. This one seemed very different to me. Could you talk a little bit about, I guess, you know, where did this novel come from for you? And what are maybe some of the differences you see between this work and your previous work?
The novel came from a meeting with a very old friend, someone I had gone to school with but hadn't seen in well over 30 years. And when we met, he told me how one summer afternoon he'd come home from school and found the body of a young woman at the bottom of his garden. This was in a tiny village where no one locked their doors. They did close them. And I was very struck, not so much by how he described that violent incident, but by how he described the way it had those few seconds had completely changed his life and made him move in very different directions. And I was at work at that time on the flight of Gemma Hardy, so I just sort of wrote it down and thought, is that something to come back to? And I held on to the idea. And two other things, I think, converged around that idea. One was the repeated trope of just so many detective stories and films, beginning with finding the body of a young woman, and my thinking, oh, does it have to always be a young woman? Could it not be somebody else? And secondly, with the discovery in my 60s that I had thought of myself as being someone who had no living relatives. And through Ancestry.com, I discovered that actually I do have quite a number of living relatives. They just all happen to live in Australia. And that made me think a lot about questions of DNA and family and affection and all those things. And so those two or three things converged in the novel. The idea of taking, if you will, the form of the detective novel, beginning with the finding of a body, but having it be a young man, having it not be fatal, and having a detective kind of thread through the novel, having the search for the crime be, if you will, the spine of the novel, but having the real focus of the novel be on these three teenagers and how each of them moves into a different quest, if you will, in response to seeing the young man who's been assaulted. And of course, to Duncan, I gave the youngest who's adopted, I gave my own preoccupations with DNA and family and what difference these things make.
Hmm. Well, it is just a wonderful novel, completely satisfying to read, a total page turner. I can't praise it enough. The Boy in the Field, Margot Livesey, thank you so much for talking with us here about it.
Thank you so much, Francesca, for your wonderful, thoughtful, insightful questions and for entering into my novel so fully. I'm truly grateful.
Margot Livesey. Read an excerpt from The Boy in the Field by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, an ER doc looks back on 25 years in the emergency room. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. They're free. And you can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. Frank Hyler is a poet and an author from Albuquerque, New Mexico. He's also been an ER doctor for 25 years. In 1999, he wrote The Blood of Strangers, True Stories from the Emergency Room, a much-acclaimed collection of vignettes describing his experience as a new ER doctor. Now, more than 20 years later, he's come out with a new memoir reflecting on the long arc of his experiences in the ER, White Hot Light, 25 Years in Emergency Medicine. In portraits that are visceral, haunting, and sometimes surreal, Hyler reveals the gritty reality of medicine practiced on the razor's edge between life and death. Well, Frank Hyler, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So this book, White Hot Light, 25 Years in Emergency Medicine, first of all, that is a long time in such a high-stress field.
It is a long time. Yes, it is. It's hard to believe that that many years have passed, but that's how life goes. And suddenly you find that you've been doing something for far longer than you thought or ever imagined that you would.
And actually, I'll ask you a little bit more about that later. But first, I'd like to first ask you about the title, White Hot Light. What does it refer to?
The title, there is a reference in the book, and I don't want to necessarily give anything away, but it's in the last story of the book, I hope that is revealed. And it's basically the sun. It's the sun rising after I leaving the hospital after a night shift. And the sun rises very blindingly in New Mexico, particularly in the winter, at that time. And so that moment to me was in a lot of ways sort of emblematic of what I was hoping to do in the book, I think, which is to sort of cast this blinding light, if I could.
You wanted to shine a blinding light on what?
Well, on a number of things. I think one of my intentions for the book is that people tend to write medical stories. The events that occur within medicine, they're concentrated and distilled in hospitals. But really, these are the events that all of us take part in our lives. These are the, in many cases, our fears and our hopes, and where our human weakness and strength is revealed. And it tends to be, in many ways, focused in hospitals, distilled down, concentrated. But the questions that arise from these interactions and the questions that come up from practicing in a hospital for many years are really the questions, I think, that are universal, that apply to us all. And so one of the messages, I hope, or intentions of this book was not simply to write about medicine, but to use medicine as a vehicle to explore some other larger questions that a novelist might be interested in, for example, or another genre of writing.
Your stories have a deep undercurrent of compassion, which is something I think that novelists have to have for their characters. But after all these decades in emergency medicine, it seems that you also, and you refer to the struggle that you have sometimes with maintaining compassion in the face of so much death. You know, you write at one point in the book, "Our cold hearts reveal us." So talk a little bit about the struggle that you have, you know, between these two poles, between kind of, you know, protecting yourself with a bit of distance and with, you know, the compassion that comes with the work that you do.
It's absolutely hard to maintain compassion or to maintain, how to say this, emotional accessibility. It's something that happens very quickly. It's one of the earliest casualties of medical training is detachment and distance and clinical distance and, you know, black humor and these sorts of things. And it's one of the first things that happens to medical students and residents when they start seeing the kinds of events that occur in hospitals. The challenge then becomes, as time passes, to try to find your way back a little bit, to realize that you don't want to lose too much. You don't want to become too deadened. And it's natural to become deadened. It's a human response. And most of the time, anybody who's done this kind of work for any length of time just can step away. What you're hoping for is that you still retain some element of being reachable. And I think that's a goal to aspire to. And partly in this book, I was in part trying to find that a little bit, to be honest. When you've seen a lot of stuff over many years, the life can become very surreal and distant, and it can spill out into your personal life. It can spill out into your perceptions of the world as a whole. And it's one of the psychological challenges that occur over time for anyone who is exposed to these kinds of events on a regular basis.
So you're talking about a kind of psychic numbing.
Absolutely. And trying to find your way through that, trying to remind yourself that this world that at least is portrayed in this book is really not the real world. It's a distillation of some of the worst events that are occurring in a city at any given day, but most people are doing just fine and living out their lives. And that it's just one point in the graph of human experience that tends to be distilled in a certain way. And you have to resist that sometimes with an act of will.
I mean, it seems to me that, post-traumatic stress disorder must be an occupational hazard for an emergency, for an ER doctor.
Yeah, I it's hard to know how to say it. I think people are far more resilient than we like to say. And it's easy to apply labels to experiences, and not to say that PTSD is not a true thing, because of course it is. And many people suffer from it greatly. But in medicine, there's a long culture of resilience, of endurance. So I would not use those terms to talk about my experiences. I wouldn't use a term of like PTSD or something pathological. I think it's more a question of what do you learn from this?
And it's so striking, you know, these stories, as you say, many of them express the worst day of many people's lives. And yet they're also really lyrical. So one can really experience that kind of tug between distance and compassion in the very structure of this book. And it's true. In one story in particular I thought about with this, there's a young man who comes in, he's OD'd on heroin. And you interleave that story with another story about you in an accident where you broke your ankle, I believe it was.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, it seems to be a story a bit about choices around drugs. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that interweaving of those two stories and why did you do that? What's the point you're making there?
Sure. So this, to set up the story a little bit, it's a young guy who comes into the ER after a heroin overdose, gets a drug Narcan that reverses heroin really like magic. He wakes up and then there's an attempt to sort of talk to him like, you know, what are you doing? You're going to die if you don't stop using. Now, this is an enormously common scenario that occurs every day in every hospital in America. And so it's very easy to detach and distance yourself from that event. And in this case, we're very far apart in age. I mean, he was basically a kid. I was basically his mother's age. And she came to try to help him. And she'd been trying to help him for years. And he kept resisting. And this is just such a common thing that we just see over and over. So the question was how to sort of pierce through that narrative that's so often repeated and becomes so routinized. And, you know, it was simple. I mean, I fell off my motorcycle. I broke my leg. I had to ride my motorcycle back 20 miles or so across the desert. It's a sort of a dirt bike. I'm not a street motorcyclist. And it hurt. And they gave me some narcotics, some oxycodone. And I took the what was prescribed and no more. But I realized about halfway through the bottle that I was liking it. And I've never done those before. And I realized that I liked it. And I knew that I could not, you know, that if I had chosen to try to get more, or that was a path that I could suddenly see how people could go down that path, and not just in an abstract intellectual way, which is how often, so often we contextualize these decisions that people make, but more in a personal way. You know, I got it. I suddenly understood it. And that was really the genesis. That was the one of the points of the story. I don't think the only one, perhaps, but one of them.
Yeah, you know, a lot of these stories also, yeah, I don't know whether I'm thinking about this because I was just in a Zoom meeting of my Zendo. Yeah, you know, I do meditation and I attend these Saturday morning, you know, meditations. And after that, we have a council. And today we were talking about not speaking ill of others, the whole idea of judgment of others. And a lot of these stories do explore that. Again, this kind of a sense, that oscillation between compassion and distance. One story that was interesting was about a physician's assistant who was, I guess, quite obese, you know, which interfered with people's acceptance of him. I wonder if you could talk about that story and what it meant for you. You know, he was a good doctor too. I mean, I'm going to use the word doctor loosely because I think PAs basically are doctors.
Well, they're not exactly, but that's a whole other thing to discuss. Yeah. But absolutely, many PAs are very fine clinicians, and he was one of them. He was a competent person, but a mystery as well. And so the story, I'm not sure how much I should give away, but it's someone I worked with who we didn't know very well, because at a major trauma center or a large hospital, you have people coming and going. You have people come and work for a few years and then they leave and so on. You have a lot of transients around you. And he was somebody who had moved from elsewhere. He was not native to New Mexico or to this area. Worked night shifts, and night shifts tend to attract people who are a little, you know, a little different maybe, often have their own reasons to work nights. And he was working nights without fail, very reliably, for years. I never really knew him. He never really knew me. We worked together. I looked at him as somebody very different from myself, someone that was hard to understand or really get, really have any great particular singular insights into. And the story sort of unfolds around what happened to him. And the sort of, in this particular case, the just terrible brutality of the world that fell on him due to slip and a fall. He was a very large man and he slipped and tore a muscle in his leg. And that unleashed this cascade of events that resulted in really a tragedy. And after after this whole thing developed, I realized more about him. I found out that he was a photographer, that he had been traveling around the state taking pictures, that he had a whole nother side to him that I had never seen. And that's the title of that story is called A Sunflower, which is about one of the photographs that he had taken. Later on, there's this very ghostly experience that many of us have now, which is the electronic medical record, where you can see notes that people wrote going back years. So you see notes on a patient's chart that someone wrote 5 or 6 or even sometimes longer now, 10 years earlier, and you can read exactly what they did in that day and what they saw in their words. So I keep coming across those notes that he wrote. And it's a very poignant every time I do that, every time I see that.
Yeah, I think it kind of underscores the temptation we have to not treat people in their individuality, which is something, you know, easy to do when you're under a huge amount of stress. I mean, in this case, he was he wasn't a patient, but that's true for a lot of the patients that you see. But these are real vignettes, real stories that go to the heart of the individuality of your patients.
Well, I hope so. I mean, we tend to see one another in categories, and that's part of the social interactions and contract between human beings. And we tend to try to categorize one another quickly. It's very hard to find an individual in the sea of that, particularly in an environment like an emergency room where you just have it's this constant sort of breathtaking passage of one person after another. You know, these are transient interactions, brief moments.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with writer, poet, and ER doctor Frank Hyler about his new memoir, White Hot Light.
This book is a sequel, basically, to a book I wrote about 20 years ago when I first started out, called The Blood of Strangers. And that book was similar in approach from the perspective of someone who's just really just beginning, someone who's just out of residency training. This book is that same, in many ways, the same setting 20 plus years later, to try to see if there's an evolution, you know, what to try to explore the sense of what does one learn as one ages? What are the conclusions you come to when being part of a strange world like this for so long? You know, how do you resist just becoming sort of distant and detached from life? Those are the sorts of things that I was asking myself as I tried to write this book. And I think a lot of people write books as in part as exploration. And this was certainly true for this book for me.
And in fact, you anticipated my question. What's different for you?
Well, there's a story in the book that talks kind of about this, which is there's certain comfort. And I hate to say it's there's a, like life ripples through you and carries on, you know. A little bit of Yeats's epitaph, you know, horsemen pass by, cast a cold eye on life, on death, horsemen pass by. You realize that you will not understand these things. I mean, I'm certainly no Buddhist, but but it starts getting into areas that I think are probably applicable too.
You know, I was really struck by the quote at the beginning of the book. I don't think we're ready to die, any of us, not without being escorted. And of course, as an emergency ER physician, you're in a position to escort people many times to their deaths. But now, so many people are not being escorted, or there's no real human touch because, you know, and so, I mean, are you seeing COVID patients in the ER? And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are about, you know, escorting people at this time, the you know, what's happening to the whole process of dying for people who have COVID in hospitals now?
Yeah. Well, that's such an enormous, terrible subject. So to answer your question, absolutely. I'm in the midst of the COVID pandemic, as are as is everyone right now. Now the COVID patients that I'm seeing in the emergency department, and so it's not the same as the ICU. And in the ICU, that's where these issues are really coming up, where people who have been on the ventilator for a long time are dying, and those sort of terrible, wrenching choices where you can't have family members come in to see them, and all of that we've read about. In my case, we are in the emergency department in the midst of this. New Mexico is better than other states so far, but this is a very difficult, challenging time for anyone in healthcare and medicine, really for everyone, anyone, period. And at the moment, I'm staying apart from my family because I don't want to bring it home. And there's no one to help us if we all got sick at the same time. So these are the sorts of decisions and choices that are being made around the country by great numbers of people. And I think when you talk about sort of the coldness in the face of death, or the lack of humanity, I think that's very true. And I also think, frankly, that it was true before COVID-19. It's not something that many people want to hear, I realize, but medicine in general is often a very cold business. And the challenge is to try to navigate your way through that as best you can, both personally and also hopefully for others. I mean, it is frankly very hard to give much of yourself in emotional terms to most of your patients. Over time, it becomes very difficult to do that. Sometimes you find yourself doing it naturally, and you sort of have an innate emotional response. And other times you feel surprisingly detached. And so one of the challenges for practitioners is to resist that detachment. And one of the challenges for systems is to not embrace the sort of overarching, I wouldn't say heartlessness, but I'm sort of struggling for the right word here, actually. It's not exactly heartlessness. It's more like a collective indifference. And that collective indifference is inevitable whenever you have a lot of suffering. When you have a lot of people dying, no matter where you are, in whatever context, that develops rapidly.
Yeah, that's true. Well, Frank Hyler, I wish we had more time to talk. In spite of, it's a collection of both beautiful and terrible stories. Terrible not in the sense of like not being good, but in the sense of bringing to mind or illuminating that white hot light on some of the most terrifying and important parts of our lives. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate you talking to me.
A few weeks ago, we spoke with writer and writing teacher K.L. Cook about his book, The Art of Disobedience. Cook teaches writing at Iowa State University, where he's also an administrator. When we spoke in July, he was in the midst of the decision-making process at those universities about whether to resume classes in person or remotely. We spoke about that for a while after the interview about his book, and here's some of what he told us. So talk about the decisions that are being made. What I've heard is that maybe students are eager to go back to in-person learning, and I can understand why, because it's really difficult to do distance learning. But professors are maybe not so eager because they're older and perhaps in higher risk groups. So talk a little bit about the politics of higher education at this point with respect to the pandemic and distance learning or not.
The politics are really complex now, and the stakes feel incredibly high. Earlier this week, some of the Ivy League schools, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, finally announced their fall plans, and they are doing most of their instruction online, even though they will have up to 40% of students on campus. They're kind of rotating freshmen and seniors, you know, the freshmen, incoming freshmen will be on campus in the fall is the plan, and the seniors in the spring for maybe obvious reasons, but they're trying to decrease the density on class. And very wisely, these Ivy League institutions, as well as places like Southern Cal or University of Chicago or Northwestern or many other colleges and universities that are adopting what I think is a sane approach, are going to have their classes primarily or exclusively online for the fall semester. And I think that that is a wise decision for a number of reasons. One, health and safety. There's no way really for an administration to say that we're providing and health and safety, or we're the health and safety are the top priorities when we're all going to be in small classrooms. We don't know where people have been. We're going to, even when the classrooms are half the size, and let's assume that all the students are wearing their mask and keeping their distance, and that's a big if. It's the whole class is going to be laced with a sense of fear and anxiety. And disruption. You know, we're going to be dealing with technology issues. We're going to be disinfecting our classrooms as teachers. We're going to be bringing Clorox wipes and wiping everything down because we don't want to be in a COVID stew from the previous class. It's just going to be so dangerous. And I think anybody who's any institution, and Iowa State University right now is planning on doing a hybrid model where the big lecture classes, over 200 or 300, will be online and most of the other classes will be in person. But I just don't see how they're going to be able to do that. There's going to be disruption, and any instructor who is asked to or volunteers to do in-person teaching is going to have a degraded experience. They're going to engage in essentially hazard work because they're in an enclosed space for 50 minutes to 3 hours with 20-somethings that they don't really know, and they don't know where they've been. And there's going to be disruption. You're going to have to, if you're an instructor for an in-person class, essentially develop three versions of your class. One for in-person teaching, and it's going to have to accommodate social distancing and other health protocols and safety protocols. You're going to have a hybrid version because you're going to have to accommodate students who either choose or get to not be in class or who get sick or have to quarantine and isolate. And you're going to have a fully online version in case you get sick and someone else to take over, or when the inevitability comes, and it will come, and the university has to retreat entirely online like we all did last spring. So it's a real burden, and it's a safety and health burden as well as just a degraded experience. People who say, and this is the primary argument that we're hearing from administrators and from students, they're saying, but in-class teaching is better than online teaching. And I agree wholeheartedly that that is the case. But those who are making that argument are comparing and contrasting a pre-COVID in-class experience with the current experience. And the current experience in class is going to be full of disruptions, going to have all sorts of technology issues and safety protocols issues. And just, it's going to be laced with fear. And you can't focus in a classroom. The whole goal of a classroom is to enter into it and be able to focus intensely without fear. And that's not going to happen.
What do you think of the news that the Trump administration is planning on deporting foreign students at universities in the United States if they are not attending classes in person?
I read this same story this morning. I was alarmed by it. On the one hand, it seems like right in keeping with the Trump administration's xenophobic policies and strategies, and to create political wedges and divisiveness, and to essentially create a sense of threat for students who, and it's a significant number of students who come from other countries, and I'm worried about how that will especially influence the public institutions like mine, Iowa State University, and the decision how we're going to protect our international students. More practically, I think that there are workarounds. I think every college and university is going to recognize what this new policy is from ICE. You know, they realize it's a political stunt. It's part of sort of a xenophobic strategy to exclude immigrants and to sort of punish colleges and universities that are not embracing the full opening of the economy. And I think that colleges and universities are going to find workarounds, just as the Ivy Leagues have done. They're saying, we want an on-campus experience. We know that that is important for students. And so we're going to have 40% of the students on campus, and we will work out safe but modified ways for people to have community, because that is important. That's one of the reasons you go to college. But that the online instruction is going to be primarily online, because that will minimize disruption. It will keep everyone safe, especially instructors who tend to be older and higher risk categories. And we're going to preserve the educational part, but we're going to still have people on campus. I think that's going to be the college and university workaround to undermine this horrible policy.
K.L. Cook. He teaches at Iowa State University. On August 25th, it was reported that in the first week of classes at Iowa State, 130 students, faculty, and staff tested positive for COVID-19, little more than 13% of the over 900 who were tested. That added to the 175 positive tests Iowa State reported previously. Now, 385 ISU students, faculty, and staff are in a 14-day quarantine period due to close contact with a known positive case. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.